they are like, how does it matter now? It is too little and too late.
Hi, I'm Grishma Kuttar, and this is Voices from the Lockdown, a First Post podcast. Today's episode is split into two segments. In the first segment, Kashmiri journalists Sana Irshad Maktu and Javed Ahmed will tell us how people in Kashmir are responding to restoration of postpaid mobile services. In the second segment, I'll be speaking to photographer Nawal Ali, where she will be narrating her experience of countering a false version of events from Kashmir. So, Sana, yeah. Postpaid services have resumed today from 12 p.m.
Yeah.
How has this been received in Kashmir? Would you say that people are relieved? Would you say that people are... How are people really reacting to this?
You know, basically people, they are like okay with this, because they have a sort of kind of acquainted with the challenge now. They really don't care if it is, you know, restored, when they are going to restore, or there are still prepaid, you know, services that are blocked. So people really doesn't care, like, what, and it doesn't matter, like, because the situation of uncertainty that started when New Delhi revoked the region's special status on 5th of August. So people are like, it's just that one day they wanted to restore the postpaid, they did it. Tomorrow they feel like blocking it, they will do it. And how does it matter? And some people are like, it's something very basic, fundamental right that we all need to have. Right. There is nothing kind of that, no, you can
call
it celebration. Yeah, but people are a bit relieved. At least they are able to reconnect with the family and friends, just to tell them that they are alive, they are surviving.
Okay, but Sana, are the restored postpaid services working efficiently? Are there any further difficulties that people are facing?
You see, again, you know, 40 lakh postpaids have been restored. But again, there are issues like bill payment, and people are not able to recharge, you know, the internet thing. This has all driven people very crazy. There are lines of people lying outside telecom centers because people, you know, they are not working. Even postpaid services, there is no outgoing call. And even incoming is not working properly.
There is no outgoing.
Because, you know, 3 months after 2 months, people reactivate their SIMs or whatever it is.
Okay, but what are the people saying on the streets of Kashmir?
I talk to many people, like, from different walks of life. Some are saying that they are doing it for the sake of publicity.
Okay.
They are like, if they had cared about tourism, or they would have had issues, they would not have issued such advisories then.
You mean that tourism stands to gain from this, considering that the sector has, you know, suffered a lot because of the lockdown?
Kuch log to aisa bhi bol rahe hain, they are doing it for the tourism only, like, they have called them to come back. Or it's only for them that phone services restore away. Other people are also saying that it doesn't now matter because season is off. And it will take a lot of time for people to convince tourists that because that business, it is very futile to the industry.
Okay, so basically what you're saying is that people are largely indifferent to this restoration of postpaid services.
People are saying that, and they are like, how does it matter now? Because special status is going to go. Why would people in Kashmir really care if phones are working or not? Or how does it make a difference now? It is too late, and it is too little and too late. You know, the whole situation has engineered chaos, confusion and helplessness among people.
Thanks, Anna. Javed, what have the residents of Kashmir you've spoken to saying?
In this, like, digital era, the mobile phone communication, it has become a basic necessity. We can't say it is a luxury. But since it has been restored now, a sort of inconvenience that people were subjected to earlier due to this blockage has now been, I mean, curtailed. So people are really, like, they have a breather kind of thing. They are facing some kind of relief. When I was today traveling from Sopor to Srinagar, I saw people, like, they were a little happy with the decision that these mobile phones are getting restored.
Right, right. How about businesses? Do you think restoration of services will help businesses salvage at least something from the losses that they've suffered before the season ends?
It may not help to the fullest. Like, see, if we talk about economy, it may help like 20% like that. Because, see, communication, people can, those who associated with their business and all, they can communicate with their clients and all. So it may prove a kind of like ease for them. to get into the business back.
But otherwise,
yes, communication is not the only thing that could restore the economy.
Right, transportation.
There are other steps that need to be taken to get back the economy on the track. It depends on the public transport. Public transport is right now suspended. You see, we talked about the Apple last time. The one of the largest fruit mandis in Sopore, it just opens for a few hours in the morning time, like from 6 to 8 in the morning or in the evening, it opens from 5 to 8. During the rest hours of the day, it remains, the business there remains suspended. So, but now with the communication lines restored, maybe people can, contact each other and they can get fruit boxes from wherever the location. I mean, if a bakery, the buyer has to pick up the stock from somewhere else. So he can contact his client or somebody else from where he wants to take the stock. So he can take it. So at least communication, this mobile phone restoration will prove helpful for them.
Mm.
At least they would come to know where they have to go and where they can get the stock.
But otherwise, like you said, unless everything else also gets back on track, things will remain pretty much on a standstill.
Yeah, because internet is yet suspended. Much of the business is taking place nowadays on the internet.
Right.
So it's not just only people who speak over phone and get everything on phone. So it also needs internet support, other support as well.
Okay, right. Thanks, Javed.
That was Sana and Javed telling us that yes, postpaid mobile services have been restored, but no, the situation is far from normal. Next up, we'll be continuing our conversation from yesterday's episode. Can reporting remain factual in the face of a lockdown when local journalists aren't in a position to report or communicate? This is something that we spoke about yesterday. What happens, especially when there are serious incidents involving violence and bodily harm, and then a report emerges saying, hey, all that is an exaggeration? Who will write the facts? Who will verify what is true from a region where journalists have been operating out of one media facilitation center with just 10 computers and one mobile phone? There is one photographer who set out to speak some truth. Nawal Ali was sent screenshots of a report written by Abhijit Iyer Mitra, a fellow at the Institute of Peace and Conflict Studies. Iyer Mitra had written about what happened during and after protests in Ansar district of Kashmir in the second week of September. He had described how he had travelled across Ansar for a day looking for pellet victims and that he hadn't found any. He described them as missing. Nawal had in fact been in Ansar when protests happened. She had photographed 5 pellet victims herself. She decided to write a rebuttal to this piece by Iyer Mitra, where she detailed what she saw and how his version of what happened was false. And for this, she had to face vitriol, name-calling and hate on social media.
Nawal, thanks for speaking to us. Let's start right from the beginning. Where were you immediately after August 5th? Were you in Kashmir itself?
Post August 5th, first of all, I was back home only in Kashmir. So I did not know what was going on the internet and in the online media publication houses. But then on the news channels, I could see how they were spreading the propaganda. So while I was there in Kashmir, I couldn't do much because I wasn't able to move outside. And because I'm not a full-time journalist, when I flew out of Kashmir, the only thing I could do was, I had these screenshots of all these news channels where they had portrayed normalcy, but, they had shown photos of Jammu and they claimed that it was Kashmir and all of that. The most I could do as soon as I flew out of Kashmir was use the social media to basically debunk all these lies. So I used my Instagram where I sort of gave a counter to all of those lies. Mm-hmm. And that time, that was the most I could do. So I flew out on the 24th of August. But then after that, again, I went to Kashmir on the 11th of September. I actually, the main aim at that time to go to Kashmir was to basically go out and see for myself what is happening and report and make write some stories.
Okay, right. How did you go about writing this rebuttal to Abhijit Iyer Mitra's piece?
The particular piece, the rebuttal that I wrote for the print, I did not intend to write it at all about the pellet victims, what I saw in Ansar, in Srinagar. I was there doing another story. I went to Ansar for 5 days. Mm-hmm. And suddenly on Friday, this happened and I had photos and I had thankfully, I was there actually. So when I flew out of Kashmir again, I had not been following Vijit Iyer Mitra's a series of articles in print. Someone actually, I was quite active on Instagram where I was answering people's questions, you know, debunking all the myths and lies and educating everybody as whatever I could do, I did in my capacity. So one of those people actually sent me a link of this article that Aditi Rayan Mitra wrote for the print. And when I saw it, I didn't even know what to say to that person who sent me the link, because it was all live. So that is
when you had been there on those days.
Yeah, on the exact day. And I had seen that boy, which he says has superficial wounds and all of that. So that is what. Yeah.
These photos are in your piece as well, so it's pretty obvious for not even to see.
Exactly. So that's what basically motivated me. And it was quite surprising, shocking, and I don't know, for lack of better words. But then that's when I wrote it, and so this was my first attempt to basically bring out a counter narrative from ground. Now, it's very difficult for Kashmiris, like you said, because of the communication blockade. So it's easier for outside journalists, non-Kashmiri journalists, to come and fly in and fly out because they have the resources and everything. But in Kashmir, the freelance journalists do not have that much of resources. They cannot do in and out most of the times, and that's why the narrative is not coming out.
Yeah, I mean, traveling in Kashmir also during a lockdown to hire a vehicle and to like...
So Kashmiris, most of them cannot do it. So although there has been, this time I would say that there is a lot of coverage in international media on Kashmir, a lot, probably most in these 70 years. So that's there, although Kashmiri voices are not coming out, that's the problem.
And what happened after you wrote the report? What kind of responses did you receive to your report?
Then, for example, I wrote the article. That journalist who had written the original article, he started a thread on Twitter and he started name calling me. Mm-hmm. And people who had been reposting that article, who had been tweeting that article, and he was just calling them closeted jihadis and whatnot, you know, ISIS propagandists and stuff like that. That was happening. And it's very difficult because like our names are out there and he's been calling and he has a lot of following. So for us, sometimes Kashmiri journalists, freelance journalists get a bit, I wouldn't say scared, but a bit worried before writing such an article, because they know what's coming, they know what the consequences. So always the pressure is on us, right? Like we have to, first of all, also, the onus is on us to give the truth out. And second, we have to also bear the consequences, which are actually very dangerous these days in India. I did not build any narrative like he did in the article, like the journalist did. I had no narrative. There was just facts. And there was nothing new in my article in the sense that I just responded to his points and the fabricated facts. That's it. There was just responses. And there was no extra information or an extra narrative that I built in that article. Because I had seen myself with people bleeding in front of me. I mean, and the chaos, suddenly the pellets were fired, there was the chaos. I was there, I was like a part of that chaos. I didn't know what to do. I was there, and all of us, there were many journalists, not just me, there were, I think, international journalists also there at that time. But yes, I mean, how I look at it is that thankfully I was there and I could debunk all this propaganda and false propaganda.
Okay, what about Iyer Mitra's article really bothered you? What was it that, you know, got to you, if I can use those words?
His words in the article were completely insensitive. I mean, he also somewhere said that, you know, I couldn't find the pellet victim and I was disappointed. I mean, and when I read that, I was like, okay, he's disappointed because he couldn't find the pellet victim. I mean, how insensitive can a person be? Mm-hmm. And when he says exaggeration, exactly, of course it's insensitive. He's basically discrediting the fact that Kashmir is a war zone right now. Mm-hmm. And so of course it's very insensitive of him. And the words he's chosen and the language he's chosen in the article is also very Islamophobic in some senses. In some,
especially when he refers to the woman as being...
When I read it, I was like, okay, this is, I don't know, at first, of course, I was shocked, but then it was very funny also in the sense that how can a person of this experience and whatever background can, you know, write in such a language? How in the end he says that, you know, Anjaris, like people of Anjar really know how to sing a yarn and make a story out of it and all of that stuff. I mean, it was just very insensitive. I mean, there is a fight going on in Kashmir. People are dying and you're writing a language like this.
Yes, yeah, that is pretty strong language. And the only thing that I can think about is, what are the editorial policies, you know, to keep a check on this kind of extremely opinionated language? I mean, how is one allowed to write using those kind of words, especially when there is hardly any information coming out of a region, and that region has zero communication, and also opinions of the journalists from there is also missing. But what did you face any difficulties while getting your report published?
So, I also actually in the original article, I did not write such a language. Mm. But then there were parts where I sort of I was very hard in terms of language, but it was edited by the editors of the publication by the end. And I was like, okay, you allowed the original propaganda to be completely, of course that must have been edited in some ways, but then I'm just saying in terms of language, I mean, I use a bit of hard language and that gets edited. So, but one thing I'll have to give to the publication is that they did not publish another rebuttal to it. Mm. That was unprofessional of them, but yeah, I mean, so probably there are.
Finally, how do you think people from Ansar or any part of Kashmir would react to a report like this?
Basically, Ansar people are very receptive to media because they want the world to see the resistance that they are basically keeping on track. Mm. So they are very receptive to media. So they say that we, at that point of time, we cannot really, we can't really guess who is who. So, but then they say ki, if they post some lies and propaganda, we'll come to know, and the next time we don't let them enter. So it of course hurts them. They say, I mean, when I was also there, they were, you know, some people were saying that, okay, media is our eyes right now. They are our, you know, spokesperson right now. So please come. But few other were like, okay, please, no, don't come. You guys go out and show lies, and that hurts our sentiments and our resistance movement. So of course it hurts them. They are very skeptical of outsiders, which was very evident in the Prince article also, the original article, where the locals were very, they did not give out information comfortably to the journalists.
I mean, what I am thinking is, when there is an information lockdown, and then a report like this emerges saying, hey, where are the pellet victims? I can't find any. How many such counter reports will people have to keep filing, you know, like you did? And then also face trolling and hatred for it. But anyway, thanks a lot for talking to us, Nawal.
That is all from this episode of Voices from the Lockdown. Tune in at 8 tomorrow for the next episode.